Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to the Optus Sport Football Podcast. I'm Mark Schwarzer and joined today, as always, by Phil Kitromilides. Phil, you were in Madrid this weekend, as always, you live there, but you went to Real Madrid, you're living at large, and then you went to, what was it, Sunday League game afterwards? I'm not quite sure. What happened?
So on Saturday, hello Schwarzy, I was invited to a box at the Bernabeu, a private box. It was absolutely spectacular. The shiny new Santiago Bernabeu. It looks incredible outside. Inside, the hospitality was really quite sumptuous, delicious, finely cut jamón ibérico, manchego cheese, all amazing. The Rioja you can swill. It was lovely. I watched Real Madrid beat Cádiz 3-0 and become champions. It was quite a plush footballing experience. And then on Sunday night, I went to the crumbling Estadio de Vallecas for a restricted view seat for the relegation clash between Rayo and Almeria, which Almeria already relegated 1-1-0. There was water dripping down through the ceiling because it was raining. It was about as opposite a footballing experience as I could have had on a Saturday. So I saw the full spectrum of football in Madrid this weekend.
How many times during that game for Rayo Vallecano did you think back at that box in Madrid, Real Madrid, and think, what am I doing? Yeah. That's the way I should be watching football each week.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to be said for, you know, bit of gritty, old school, proper football stadium. But when the roof is leaking and the drains in the toilets are overflowing, you're thinking, yeah, maybe, guys, maybe the Bernabeu's a bit better. So, yeah, it was interesting. It was an interesting sociological experience.
Well, you'd hope the Bernabeu is better, considering how much money they've spent on renovating the whole thing, obviously. We're also joined by Julien Laurent. Hi, Jules. How's it going, mate?
Hello, boys. Very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Pleasure. Absolutely pleasure to have you here. Let's go straight into it. Let's talk about, Phil's biggest game of the weekend anyway. I mean, forget about the Bernabeu. Forget about Rayo Vallecano. It's Liverpool against Tottenham. Tottenham were going to go on for were they going to continue their disastrous run or mini disastrous run of losing four games in a row? And yes, they did. Liverpool absolutely steamrolled them, didn't they, Jules? Never really a contest until I think Richarlison came on and possibly kind of changed the game a little bit for Spurs, but it was a brief glimmer of hope.
Yeah, I didn't really think even at 4-2 when Spurs scored in the 72nd and 77th minute that they could come back. It was such a dominant performance from this Liverpool side for most of it. I mean, the first half I thought was embarrassing from a Spurs point of view and an Ange Postecoglou point of view. One shot, I'm not even sure we can count it as a shot, to be fair. And you really wondered what was going on because, okay, they've had four defeats in a row now against some tough opposition, away at Newcastle, against Arsenal, against Liverpool, away at Chelsea. So you can understand, but at times it's more the performances that I thought were worrying more than anything else, because you can lose, it happens, you can concede goals, although they've conceded a lot in those four games. But I thought Liverpool were in control completely, and yes, there's the two late goals for Spurs, which is good to see because that means they didn't give up. But overall, I'm just not really sure what is happening with that team around Ange. Even his own communication saying in his changes, of course, in his changing in that squad, maybe the squad is not good enough for him or for what he wants the squad to do and the team to do and the players to do. But overall, I just thought those four defeats just tarnish a little bit the really good things that we've seen earlier in the season from Spurs.
You said it was a big game, Schwartzy, and a couple of weeks ago, it would have been a big game, but coming into it, it felt like for both sides that there wasn't really that much at stake because Liverpool had kind of lost their Premier League title aspirations and Tottenham had had those three successive defeats and looked like Champions League was beyond them. So from that starting point, it felt a little bit flat, but then Liverpool came flying out the blocks and as Jules said, there was nothing from Spurs in that first half. It was dreadful performance, and I've heard people say that Spurs look leggy, Spurs look a bit tired. Why? Why are they tired? They haven't had European football. They haven't gone deep in the cups. They've had, broadly speaking, the whole squad fully fit for the last few weeks. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a reason why they are so lethargic. And there does seem like there needs to be changes this summer in terms of personnel. Obviously, Udoji is a big miss at left back, and Emerson Royal coming in there and being not particularly good, but playing, broadly speaking, to the expectations of most Spurs fans, he's not really good enough to replace Udoji. It's really disheartening. That said, Ange has kind of done the season in reverse, because if he'd started how he's finishing and ended the season with the form that he started with, I mean, what was it? 8 wins in the first 10 games, something like that. 26 points from 30. It was a really good start. If we'd finished the season like that, it would have been a whole different complexion, even if you have the same number of points. So, you know, we should read into that a little bit as well. But overall, and the thing is, Jules says, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on. I haven't heard any sort of coherent explanation or analysis as to why Spurs are playing as badly as they are, because I'm not sure there is one. I genuinely don't know. And maybe the problem is that Ange doesn't seem to know either. I'm not sure.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because they literally have fallen off a cliff in terms of the way they're playing, the style of which they're playing. I think that's the biggest concern for me. No, well, not literally, but in terms of the style, I just can't see it anymore. I can't see the high press. I can't see the energy. And that's the biggest worry. And Ange obviously is getting grumpier and grumpier and more frustrated. I mean, James Maddison's completely fallen away. Son, obviously, I mean, you can go through the whole list of players. People have just really, really struggled. And that's probably the biggest concerning factor of this, Jules. And I don't think you can actually just go, well, end of the season, a lot of changes in personnel. You're going to have to bring in... That's not Ange's way, I don't think. You know, from what I've seen him in the past and how he's operated, it's just completely, something is not quite right at the moment.
Yeah, you're right. There was a moment in the Chelsea game, I don't know if you saw it, where he gets really, really angry and said to the players, "F-ing pass the ball forward."
Yeah.
Because clearly in his liking, the ball was going either too much sideways or too much backwards. And as we know, he wants that verticality. He's always wanted it. And either the players could not find it. So if you can't find the pass vertically, so in front of you to go forward, then you don't want to lose the ball. So maybe you play sideways or backwards again. Maybe they didn't want to take the risk. Maybe the movement, like you said, Schwarzy, and maybe the players without the ball to run into spaces was not just right. I don't know. But if by this time of the season, the players are playing against what you want, in a way, it's hard to explain in a way, but you want them to pass the ball forward all the time to find that verticality. If they don't, there's a problem somewhere, clearly, like we've been saying. One of them, for me, one of the problems is that James Maddison was clearly at the center of everything when Spurs were doing well, especially those first 10 games, as we said, unbeaten, etc., etc. But even after that, until his injury, so much that he clearly had a lot of freedom and the ball was going to him a lot. He would drop deep, he would get the ball there and he would start the build-up phase and you would find him again a little bit higher up on the pitch. And then he would be even decisive with a goal or an assist or a second assist higher up the pitch. So he was everywhere. From the moment where Maddison is not that guy anymore because he's had the injury, because clearly he's maybe not fully fit, he's lost a bit of confidence, and just lost a bit of confidence in him, then you lose what was at the center, at the heart of a lot of what you were doing well earlier in the season. And maybe nobody can replace him, not a Lo Celso, not a Kulusevski, not a Son, I don't know, anyone really. So by losing him, or losing that kind of profile, maybe you lose a lot of what Ange Ball is about. And that's pretty much all I can offer in terms of explanation, boys, sorry.
I think you're absolutely right. And In this game, you were speaking about this shortly before we came on air. You thought that, you know, Richarlison really, really changed the game when he came on, and he did, and Spurs looked really different. But doesn't it... I don't know if there was fitness issues, but isn't it obvious that Son should play on the left, where he's one of the best in the world, and with a central figurehead of a striker like Richarlison, everyone seems to play a little bit better. And Maddison, apparently he had a knock, that's why he didn't start. Okay, but I mean, he seemed okay when he came on. It just seemed like that was obvious that Son should be on the left and Richarlison should be starting. And what Jules was saying in terms of there's no one really to replace Maddison. There isn't. I mean, the midfield three that was selected for this game is Bissouma, Sarr and Bentancur. I mean, there's no one even close to the profile of James Maddison. So yeah, maybe the drop off in form and from Maddison goes some way to explaining why structurally Spurs haven't been set up to play the way that Ange wants them to be playing in the last few weeks. But the intensity has dropped off big time, Jules.
But for example, just to finish on that, I'm not comparing Maddison and Odegaard, but imagine taking Odegaard out of your Arsenal team for 3 months for injury, for example, like Maddison had. And then even when Odegaard comes back, he's not as good or as fully fit as... Arsenal would not be the same at all without Martin Odegaard, for example, in a season because of everything that he does. And yes, Saka is maybe the most important player like Son is for Spurs. But if you take Odegaard is what makes this Arsenal team quite special in everything he does with the ball, without the ball, the pressing, the running, the creativity, all of that. If you take him out and replace him, I don't know, a Smith Rowe or Fabio Silva or, you know, whoever you want, really, even Trossard there, it won't be the same. And I'm not saying that Maddison yet is as important as what Odegaard is now for Arsenal. I'm just saying sometimes one player is so much at the heart of everything that you've built for your team around that if you take him out or if he's not as good, then the whole team really struggle with it and suffer from it.
Sorry, Jules. You did compare Odegaard and Maddison with Odegaard.
No,
you did. Like you, no,
I knew you weren't going to
say
that. You
did. Like, honestly, Phil, I thought he did. Did you, Phil?
He compared their importance to the team.
Oh, you are such
you're
a friend sitter, honestly.
Is not a friend.
You are this a fence sitter.
Listen, you goalkeepers stick together, so us European journos are sticking together, all right?
Hey, I'm going to catch up. I'm catching up with Ange on Tuesday, so tomorrow. So you put your journalistic heads on. What would you ask him right now? What would be the one question? You each got a question to ask him right now, only one. What would you ask him? Bearing in mind, you don't actually have to ask the question. Someone else is me.
What's gone wrong, Ange?
Is that what would you ask? Just an open question. What's gone wrong?
Yeah. I mean, you can phrase it in a different way, but I would like to hear him try and analyse and explain to us why Spurs have lost four matches in a row, conceding the number of goals that they've conceded and putting in the kind of lethargy. I mean, Newcastle was terrible. Chelsea was appalling. They were battered for the first bit by Arsenal, even though they had the ball. Even though they had the ball, I felt that they were completely dominated by Arsenal, who had 25% possession. It was... Yeah, it's been a difficult few weeks, and I'd like him to try and explain why. Not from like an angry perspective, like you tell us why this has gone wrong, but just from an analytical perspective. Ange, like, what why is this happening? Why do you think this is happening?
I would ask him, Schwartzy, because he said he needs changes in this squad, so some players would go. They've already let some go, obviously, and more some new players will arrive. I don't know if he would tell you how much investment he's planning to do and how much the club has already promised him to be able to do, because as we know, Daniel Levy is maybe not the most accommodating of owner or, you know, CEO, whatever you want to call him. But maybe, and again, he won't answer to you, but like, okay, who do you want to get rid of? Who's really annoyed you this season where you watched him play and you said, nah, he's not for me. I can't, he can't play my style of football. So, you know, could that be Højbjerg? Could that be Bentancur? Would that be, I don't know, Kulusevski? Because clearly when he said the other day, we need some changes here in the squad. The squad is not what I need for my football. So clearly some starters and key players in that squad he thinks are not good enough. So I would like to know, because we all have our opinion. We all watch the games, and Phil especially more because he's been watching them for years and years and years. And you think, okay, we know what Ange wants. Clearly he's not for that style of football, or he can't do that, or he can't play like that. And we go back to that scene at Stamford Bridge against Chelsea when he said, like, stop passing the ball backwards. We know who passed the ball backwards, who were clearly... maybe doesn't have the bravery to play like what Ange wants, or he's just not, he's not doesn't want to take those risks, or maybe he's not able to play the ball forward enough because he's just not good enough.
I might ask him that question off air. I don't think I'll ask him that exact question on air, because I'm pretty sure he won't give me an answer on that one. Jules, you just go, what are you asking that for? You know, but yeah, I know what you're saying.
But you know, this is an interview, Schwartzy, where you're going to get a lot off air,
of course,
that would be super interesting, you know, from Ange, because he probably has a lot to say, but that stuff that he can't all probably say publicly.
No, that's right. So, yeah, I mean, no pressures, right? No pressures on. Thanks, guys, for that. You mentioned earlier on, Phil, about the fact that neither team really had much to play for. But when you look at the back of Liverpool's recent run, losing 2-0 in the derby, then obviously drawing 2-2 away from West Ham, and both performances were below average, poor performances from a Liverpool side. The talk of, you know, the possibly players falling out, Salah obviously having a dummy spit on the side of the pitch at West Ham. They needed to put in a performance, didn't they? They really did need to put in a proper performance at home to appease the crowd, but also on behalf of Jurgen Klopp to a large degree, right, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was pretty much a perfect afternoon for Liverpool in every single aspect. It was a gloriously sunny day in Merseyside, which, you know, they're pretty few and far between. It felt, even beforehand, and I said it felt a little bit flat, but then we saw images of the Kop singing You'll Never Walk Alone and Jurgen Klopp just sort of soaking it in, taking it all in, his penultimate home game, the penultimate time he's going to hear that song. And it felt like this was an important game for him personally. The team played extremely well. Salah played the whole game. I mean, they played extremely well until they didn't, which is what happened when Spurs came into it with their changes, and Liverpool's changes disrupted the game a little bit, according to Klopp. But overall, a really good day at the office for Liverpool. Salah scored, played the whole game. His celebration was a little bit muted, maybe, but generally speaking, it was important for him to score and maybe show his commitment after last week's touchline spat with the Klopp. And Klopp was lavishing praise on him afterwards as well, saying how well he played. So, yeah, it was a perfect afternoon for Liverpool. As you said, they needed it to bounce back from the disappointment of drifting out of the title race that we thought they were going to be in right until the very end, which mathematically they're not out of, but realistically they're still probably not in it. But yeah, a really, really good afternoon from Liverpool. A great performance and some really, really good goals scored as well.
So you look at Liverpool, and Phil mentioned before, he said about Tottenham, and the question I should ask Ange about, why has it gone wrong? Where has it gone wrong? Talk about Liverpool and what they've had to play for, all the competitions they were still involved in. Everything was so rosy at Anfield, but then all of a sudden it went so wrong. What happened to them, Jules?
Yeah, it's really interesting because obviously the quadruple was potentially there for them. I never really thought they played that great this season, I won't lie. It's a team that was, I felt, a lot reactive, more than proactive in games. For, they would win it late, for example. At Forest, away at Palace as well, for example, earlier in the season. Some games, which is great because it's your character, you know, you're staying in the game. Even if you concede the first goal, at times, remember Brighton at home a couple of months ago where they went behind early and then they had to find their way back. But I think in the end, the issue, certainly in the second half of the season, was the lack of efficiency attacking-wise. They had so many chances in so many of those games that they didn't take. I mean, the 2-2 draw at Old Trafford against United, where their expected goals is almost 4, some clear chances there. The defeat against Crystal Palace at Anfield, which is the one really that hurt the most, because it came straight after the defeat against Atalanta in the first leg of the Europa League quarterfinals. This one where, again, they should have easily scored 2 or 3 goals and Palace could have scored more in the first half. But overall, Liverpool also deserved something, I think, in that game. Was just not there. Salah, Darwin, Luis Diaz, Jota was injured back then, Gakpo coming off the bench. All of them not being clinical enough. And there's a point where if your defence is a little bit shaky, which they've been at times, and your forwards don't take their chances, you're going to be in trouble at some point. And yeah, you can save a game there and there, like away at Forest, where they don't deserve to win, but somehow they find a way. But overall, it catches up on you. And I think this is what happens for them, unfortunately, in the end of the season.
Saturday lunchtime, Arsenal had an opportunity to put a little bit more pressure on Man City as they kicked off earlier against Bournemouth. I mean, they comfortably beat them 3-0. Actually, I think that was a bit of a sort of not a true reflection of the game. I think they could have won that game far, far more easily. However, they were given a penalty, which, come on, Arsenal have been one of the biggest critics of VAR. I thought it was very, very soft. We talked about Real Madrid a couple of weeks ago, the penalty that they got at home. How soft the penalty was at Jules? I thought okay, there is contact, but geez, it's so, so light.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was soft as well. I thought it was a really kind one given to Kai Havertz. I like Iraola's comment after the game, the Bournemouth manager, who said, well, if this is a pen, no problem, but I'm going to start telling my players, my forwards, to try to go and get that kind of contact too, because really that's not what you say to your player in a normal circumstance. So I thought it was soft. I you're right. I think Arsenal were still too good for Bournemouth, even with the Bournemouth goal that was disallowed. That was also quite a bit soft, I thought.
All I would say to that is, right, and I've been in that situation before, in that instance, you only need the softest of touches. It's like a player going up to try and head the ball. The player tries, all he's doing is focusing on the ball, and someone comes and does the slightest of nudges, yeah, but it knocks you out of the way. It happened the other week. What game was it? It was a game the other week. I think it was even possibly a Champions League game where the ball was above him. He went to head it, and he got nudged, and he headed it back up in the air, and they scored from it. And and it was a foul, in my opinion, because it, even though it's a slice of nudges, the player has no intention to go for the ball. All he wants to do is put the other player off. For me, that is a foul because, again, the goalkeeper's watching the ball. All he's doing is trying to go and punch the ball. Phil's shaking his head and laughing. Yeah, you only need...
Luton. Remember Schwartz at Luton this season? There's one where I think Adebayo blocks the keeper.
Yes. You only need the slightest of touches. And if, for me, there's no intent to go get the ball and your intention is only to obstruct the goalkeeper or the player in another instance, I think that is a foul, as soft as it may seem.
I'm laughing because it's the goalkeeper's union in full force.
Yeah.
I just know exactly what that's like. I've been there. It's happened to me. It happened in the World Cup, actually, in 2006. Exactly the same thing happened to me. And I didn't get a free kick and the referee apologised to me at halftime.
All I would say
is, mistake.
You're saying the slightest of touches, you are allowed to touch your opponent.
It was a shoulder, right? So what he's done is, he's not even gone for the ball. He knows that the keeper's coming out. All he's doing is to try and nudge the keeper to knock him off the ball. He has no intention of trying to win the ball. So if he goes for the ball and they collide, that's different, completely different. But he's got no intent whatsoever to even go for the ball. So all his intent is to put the keeper off, and he does that by knocking him, like by nudging him, even though it's a slight touch.
Absolutely disagree. Fundamentally respect
of course
your
you
opinion,
do.
But I do not agree with that at all. And I think a lot of people, but obviously you have literally been there. You've literally been in that kind of situation. So obviously I respect what you're telling me, but from a fan's perspective, looking at that call, thinking, no chance. But
yeah, but it's an easy example. I could get you on a football pitch literally and show you within a minute how much you just get obstructed and how you, it's impossible to get the ball. It really is. I mean, one of the best players of ever doing it was Alan Shearer. And he did it in a different way. So he did it in a sense that as the ball was coming to him, what he would do is he'd always be looking on the turn, half turn at the defender. And the minute he went to jump the defender, he nudged him.
Okay, cool. So we'll just stop Ben White doing everything that he does at corners as well, yeah? So
well, undoing the goalkeeper's glove. I know, but that's just, petulant. Yeah. Petulant. He needs to go on the naughty step. Absolutely. Yes. Naughty step, that time is. I want to mention Leandro Trossard. That's what you said before, didn't you, Jules? Is that kind of close?
Trossard. You don't say the D at the end. I don't know why English people, English people or English-speaking people, Giroud never said the D at the end.
Yeah.
Trossard, don't say the D at the end. But I keep hearing Trossard, Giroud.
But this is where it never made sense to me. Then why put the D on the end if I'm not supposed to mention it?
But then sometimes, like Payet, you have to say the T at the end. But you don't say the D for Giroud. Yeah, I know.
Why put it on there? Come on.
I know, you're right. That's a fair point. Yeah,
anyway,
that is a fair point.
I just wanted to mention him because he's had a huge impact at Arsenal, certainly in the, sort of seems like more so the latter parts of the season. He's scored 11 Premier League goals now, 15 goals in total. He's kind of adopted French, isn't he? Even though he's Belgian, he speaks French and everything else. And I saw your eyes light up when you mentioned him earlier on. So, have you been surprised at how much of an impact he's had? Because when he left Brighton, there was a kind of lot of animosity towards him, certainly from Brighton players and the staff and fans.
Yeah, and you saw when Arsenal went back and he scored, by the way, the last goal only a few weeks ago, that they still haven't really forgotten the fact that he left and maybe how he left. Last season, really interesting because he arrived obviously January a year ago, so not the last January, the one before, to be a sub because Martinelli was playing so well at the time. Him, Gabriel Jesus and Saka were the Arsenal front three, and Trossard was always coming to be potentially to replace either one of those three, either as a nine or a false nine. He could play on the right, can play on the left, he can even play a little bit deeper. So he offered that kind of versatility, but not really as a starter. And even at the start of this season, I'm not sure if in Arteta's mind he was really a starter. Mm. But because Martinelli hasn't been as good as last season, because, well, Havertz didn't start up front. It's only since really the turn of the year that he moved, of December, that he moved up front. I think there was more game there for Trossard overall. There was more opportunities, less of an impact sub, more as a starter. And especially in the last few weeks, I think he's really can taken that role as his own, and now he's a starter. Now he's one of the first name on the team sheets, I think, really. And he's been delivering so well. And he's such an interesting player because he's as good with his left foot, maybe, than his right foot, pretty much. Maybe not exactly as much, but he's got a good left foot for a right footer. So he can go either way. He's a good finisher. He clearly has a good work rate too. So it ticks a lot of the boxes of what Arteta would want from a wide player, for example. And that's why he's been really, really interesting. And also, people have discovered that he's the twin brother of the French referee Clément Turpin, which I think for a lot of people, that just blew their mind how much they look like each other.
I still can't get over it. It's almost sinister how much they look like each other. Like, how are these two people not related? It's very strange. But yeah, no, I mean, he's been an extremely impressive character as how he's sort of ousted Martinelli. And I think he's got more footballing intelligence than Gabriel Martinelli. And Martinelli's got that sort of explosiveness, that almost unpredictability. But Trossard's got more creativity. And if he's added an impressive amount of goals to his game as well. And he scored in some big games this season. You know, he scored in the Champions League, scored against Bayern Munich, against Liverpool, against Chelsea. It's been impressive. And I think Arteta, as Jules said, he's got him in the first 11 now, one of the first names on the list.
Another player that's just come back from injury is obviously Erling Haaland. I mean, he seems to be back to his absolute best. And even though he's been phenomenal on the pitch, which he scored four goals on the weekend, we'll get onto that very shortly. The bit that I really like at the moment is the whole thing with Roy Keane. When he called him almost a League Two level player, which, wow, I mean, he's not even a League Two level player, apparently. And the fact that he's come back, and when Haaland was asked about it, he said, "I really don't care that much about that man, so that's all right." And now, obviously, Roy Keane's fired back with saying that he's petulant because of the way he got taken off and then had a bit of a dummy spit on the weekend. That, to me, is a great little side story. And obviously, the history between Haaland's dad and Roy Keane, obviously, is everyone's well known about it. How important is it for City over these last couple of games to have a player of Haaland's ability to be back, but not only his ability, but also seemingly now to be back at his very, very best? He scored two headers, which were the one header. The second one was phenomenal. It was, the commentary even said, Ronaldo-esque in terms of the height that he got. And then his fourth goal, the finish, was sublime. Jules, he's kind of... It's funny because I feel like... he's had an average season, but his stats tell otherwise.
Yeah, I don't agree with the average season, I won't lie.
It feels like he hasn't.
No. Yeah, you're right. And if you look at even the stats and the underlying stats, the expected goals and the chances missed, it's pretty much like it was last season. It's just that he hasn't played as many games because there was a few.
All right, he's had an average season for Haaland. For Haaland,
yeah, Schwartz, no, I agree with you on that. But then, how did you think that he could reproduce what we saw last season and the incredible first year he had in?
Realistically, no, but yes.
So which one?
He's so good.
So which one is?
Because he's so good. Like, right, that's why. Like, you know, this is the thing, right? It's very, very harsh to say what I said, but the bar is so, so high. It's like Ronaldo, Messi all the time kind of thing. You know, I'm not saying he's at that level right now because he's not, but it's like that. The bar is so high every time that you kind of go, the minute they dip down a little bit, you go, oh, he's not been anywhere as good as last season.
Yeah, so last season he scored 36 in 35, right? Yep. In the, that's only in the league. and his expected goals was 28.
Yeah.
So if you like if you like data and expected goals, and if you don't, I understand. But if we just explain it, 28 is the goals he was supposed to score in that position that most of players score in that position, in the position that he was in, right? To not even beat that, but to destroy that by 8 goals, that means he scored 8 more goals than what you expected him to score, basically, in the position that he was. So 8 really good finish at some point that other players don't really finish that way and don't score from there, if you see what I mean. This season, so this was already, which shows this is not normal, Schwartzy. It's not normal. Like, even, you know, this is what Cristiano and Messi, Cristiano and Messi are bad examples, I get that. But usually strikers of the level of Haaland, Kylian, for example, but others too, would have the goals tally pretty much at the same level as their expected goals because they're that good. So when they have a chance, usually they score it. But for him to just destroy completely his expected goals tally from last season in the league to score those 36 goals was outstanding. Something that was not really sustainable if you believe in data. This season, there's less games because of the injuries that we just mentioned. 28 games, 25 goals for an XG of 26. So he scored the goals that he was supposed to score. And there's some chances that he had, but that this time he didn't take because it was a harder chance than the one that he scored.
So he hasn't been as good as last season, right?
He's been as good as last season, but not as exceptional in some moments with chances that he had last season. And that shows that last season he was just walking on water. Everything he was doing was going in. Bang, bang, bang.
So he's had a bad season this season, right?
So he had a really good season. And for his level, this is his level more than last season.
I'm winding you up, obviously.
Do you see what I mean?
Yes. No, of course.
For example, the goal last season, remember against Dortmund in the Champions League, the Cruyff finish almost, where he kind of put his feet super high to kind of do a ninja volley backwards. This is not a goal they should score, and he might not have scored again, but yeah.
How much do you think the absence of Kevin De Bruyne for a long part of the season affected his performance?
Yeah, for sure.
It did, right? Because obviously De Bruyne has come back into the team, but he's already got 15 assists and he's missed 4 months of the season. So having Kevin De Bruyne back in the team might be some kind of correlation of Erling Haaland's form. I haven't looked at the goals and compared it to when De Bruyne came back into the team, but I think having him in the team helps Manchester City. And if they're structurally more sound and better with De Bruyne in it, then that's better for Haaland.
I was just going to say, like, look, there's no doubting the guy is a freak, really, in terms of football, on the pitch, goal scoring, return, ability. Right now, this right moment in time, is he the best striker in the world? Because there's another name that just straight away comes to light, right? Harry Kane. Who's better? Who would you go with?
I thought you were going to say Kylian Mbappe.
I thought you were going to say the French lad.
No, but like Kylian Mbappe, I don't necessarily see as an out-and-out striker like Kane and Haaland. I see Kylian... I mean, Kylian plays often... Correct me if I'm wrong,
true,
Jules.
That's true, yeah.
He plays out wide a lot, right?
No.
And comes in. So I kind of don't... When you talk about out... That's why I said out-and-out striker. For me, okay. It's Haaland, Kane, Lewandowski. They're out-and-out strikers. You kind of wouldn't... You wouldn't play them anywhere else, right? Other than a number nine role.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I don't think it would be advisable. But no, you're right. If we're putting Lewandowski at number three, I think currently he's way behind.
Okay, who else is there? I mean, Dobrik at Girona has been outstanding, but I don't think he's even in that list, right? There's nowhere near that list. But then who else is there at the moment? Who else is there at the moment? Apart from Haaland and Kane as number nines, who is there?
Ollie Watkins?
No, you've got Isak. Yeah, you've got good young players or good players. Isak is a really good talent, I think. Watkins is a good player too. But yeah, no, apart from Haaland and Kane are clearly...
Clear. Yeah.
Above, so who do you pick?
Even Lautaro Martinez and, you know, Vlahovic, those kind of strikers, Boniface at Leverkusen. They're still not, I think, at the level of Haaland and Kane.
But then, I mean, Harry Kane is a better footballer than Haaland, isn't he?
More complete, for sure.
He's a more complete footballer, and he's got not far off the same numbers in terms of goals scored as Haaland, so I'm obviously picking Harry Kane.
Are you?
Is there a debate, boys, about Haaland in big games this season, for example? So the debate that we had about, you know, how good the season is or not, but No goals in the two games against Real Madrid in the Champions League quarterfinals. No goals against the two.
Not
no
even any chances. Games. Yeah, he was.
Yeah,
he was
no goals
nowhere near
in the two games against Arsenal in the league this season. And again, to Phil's point just now on Real Madrid, no chances either in those two Arsenal games, which is not all Haaland's fault if there's no service to him. But still, no goal at Newcastle, for example. No goal against Newcastle in the FA Cup. No goals at Liverpool. One goal against United. He didn't score in the draw against Chelsea, for example. So there's a few games this season when they lost Aston Villa, he didn't score either. So against Leipzig, the first game, he didn't score. So there's a few big, big games. I'm not talking the four goals against Wolves or a goal against Forest or goals against Burnley, goals against Luton, that maybe even you, Schwartzy, at the peak of your career could have somehow scored.
No, definitely not.
No, okay, maybe not even you. Okay.
Definitely not.
But do you see what I mean? And I'm not picking on Haaland, and I'm not in the Rokin camp in that, because I think he's amazing. But is there a conversation to have about him in those big games, City in those big games, in terms of their service to Haaland, how to find Haaland memo, how to involve him in the game a bit more than what we've seen in all those games that I mentioned where he didn't score. And really, when he doesn't score, he doesn't do much else either. We know that.
Or is it because he's playing, when he plays against those sort of teams, they've got better defenders, right? There's more of a target on someone like Haaland to mark him out of the game. Haaland's job then part of the time is to actually take a lot of pressure off the rest of his team, give his rest of his teammates more space. There is that argument, right? So I think having played with different types of strikers throughout time, I mean, we had, as an example that I had playing for Australia at a World Cup, Mark Viduka didn't score a goal at the World Cup, but his influence and his job in that game in that time was, yeah, of course, to score goals, but it was far bigger than that. There was disruption. It was link-up play. It was all that sort of stuff. So I think it's not as straightforward as that. But I get what you're saying, and that people will always ask that question if he's not scoring against the likes of Real Madrid, you know, against the big-name teams in big, big games on big occasions. Didier Drogba scored all the time at Wembley. Whenever Chelsea went to Wembley in big games, he scored. In big games, full stop, always scored. And there was something about them playing in those games that lifted them completely to another level. And maybe, I don't know, maybe with Haaland, it's a bit like he just keeps doing what he does each week. And maybe that slight extra focus or attention to detail maybe is not quite there, where with maturity it may come even, I don't know. I'm trying to, you know, clutch at straws, I think.
I'm just looking up Harry Kane's goals in big games this season. He's got quite a few goals in big games, guys.
People will argue a lot of those are pens as well. Like, he scored, obviously, against Real Madrid, he scored a pen. But still, I don't get that bullshit about, well, it's just a pen. I think
penalties are still goals.
It's still goals, and it still takes an incredible amount of self-belief and confidence to step up and take a penalty. It doesn't matter when it is. Jules, I want to ask you about this. Bayern Munich apparently want Ten Hag. I mean, he's probably about fourth or fifth or sixth on the list, because there's a whole list of people who have turned down Bayern Munich. Do you see that being realistic?
Well, obviously they know him well, and he knows the club well, having been there before as coach of the reserve, the second team, when in the Guardiola era. And maybe that's where this come from. It seems that in Germany, people have a different perception. Not different. Have a perception where they take more in consideration what people have done even a long time ago, like a Rangnick, for example.
Yep.
More than what they've done recently. And because otherwise...
But Ralf Rangnick's done incredibly well with Austria. I have to say, he's done a really, really good job
with
Austria.
Okay, but for 6 months.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah, I mean, not for that long.
Yeah.
But still, Does that earn you the Bayern Munich job? I'm not so sure. I love Ralf Rangnick, and you know, but it was a weird choice, I think, when you're Real Madrid to go for a 65-year-old who really, apart from 6 months at United, the last time he coached a club, I'm not saying the national team, but a club, was 12 years ago or something. But for Ten Hag, what I loved about Ten Hag this season, I won't lie, his press conferences. For me, I sit down with the popcorn. He's doing stand up now. For me, he's a comedian, and he talks, and he comes up with those incredible lines, like he did on Friday when he said, "Oh, well, we've been the most entertaining team in the league this season by far. It's so much fun to watch Manchester United." I went, "If you're a United fan, by the way, surely you don't agree with that." He said, "We create so many chances." Okay, let me have a look. Chances created, 9th in the league. Attacks, I think the 8th or 7th. Expected goals, again, to go back to data, just to have maybe a better idea. The 7th again. So no, Eric, this is not true. You are not entertaining. You don't create the most chances in the league. You don't score that many goals. Your goal difference is +1, which is not entertaining. Because yeah, you concede a lot of goals, but you don't score many, and you don't create many chances either. So I've just loved him being in denial completely, trying to convince his own bosses not to sack him by coming up with those ridiculous lines that are actually not even factually true.
Are you not better off if you're
sorry,
Ten Hag?
That was my Ten Hag rant. Sorry,
I enjoyed it actually, and it just led me on to another question: is that if you're not Ten Hag, right? And looking at his background in terms of how he's managed before at Ajax in a structure, in a system where all he has to do is concentrate on the players coming through a system from ground up to the top. Bayern Munich, you have the best talent within, like some of the best talent, a lot of the best talent, the younger players coming through, the ability to attract top, top class players, money is there, and you don't necessarily have to worry necessarily about the selection of players. You tell them what you want, they go and bring a list of players, and you go and make a selection, and that's kind of what Ten Hag has done. Man United is a bigger issue, right? It's such a juggernaut, and there's so many things that need to be addressed. Wouldn't you as Ten Hag go, yeah, Bayern's had a bad season, but they'll bounce back, and it's more suited to him?
He would jump at this. This is an amazing chance for Ten Hag.
I would have thought
he probably didn't. Yeah, I'm sure he's like very surprised to be linked with this, given what's gone on with Manchester United this season, and given just how an enormous club Bayern Munich are. I mean, you go there, you're probably going to win the league. Statistically speaking, you're probably going to win the league. You're going to be in the latter stages for the Champions League. You're going to get some money to spend, and I mean, it's a no-brainer for Ten Hag. Obviously, the suggestions are that the club haven't directly spoken to him yet. They've spoken to his people. But I think if they do speak, if and when they do speak to Ten Hag, I don't think they'll have to convince him too much, because it feels like a win-win for almost everyone, apart from maybe Bayern Munich. But yeah.
Well, the big news on the weekend, of course, was Championship, the conclusion of the season. Promotion. We knew that Leicester City were getting promoted directly, but it was always still open about who would finish second. Likelihood was going to be Ipswich Town, and of course they took it over the line. What an amazing accomplishment. I mean, just to give you a little brief summary, Kieran McKenna, first time back in 20 years, more than 20 years in the Premier League with Ipswich Town. He was described as hugely talented and highly respected. The two phrases that we used when he joined or left Manchester United, joined Ipswich Town. They were 12th in League One when he took over. He guided them to back-to-back now to promotions, and they earned more than 90 points in each campaign, scoring 193 goals in the process. Even more remarkable is that Ipswich Town only spent £4 million on signings in the last summer, coming up from League One. And whilst Leicester, Leeds and Southampton certainly spent a lot more, but also had the parachute payments from the Premier League, Leicester spent on two players 17.5 mil. And Leeds reportedly spent more on those on two players as well. So putting that all into context, and people often leave clubs and often described as talented and really good coaches, but aren't able to put it into practice. Kieran McKenna, I mean, it's almost like fantasy football, right, Jules? What he's done?
So impressive, because like you said, Schwarzy, as well, Leicester, Southampton, Leeds had Premier League squads. Let's be honest here. They had players who are Premier League players. This Ipswich squad is not like that at all. So to do what he did, back-to-back promotions, by the way, for his first two full season as a coach, since he took over, when you said when they were 12th in League One, no manager in the four professional leagues in England have won more points than him. not Pep, not Klopp, not Arteta, just nobody else. He's been that impressive. He's 37. He's still so, so young. And I remember when he was Solskjaer's assistant at United.
And Jose Mourinho.
Clearly, he was frustrated. He seems to know more or better than them in a way, and clearly left because it was just not being heard enough, or he felt that he had better things to do than just be a number two or number three, even at a big club like United. So really well done, really impressive things.
I think, guys, we need to remember to use his full name, which is 37-year-old Kieran McKenna. We have to prefix that every single time that you talk about him, because it is such a ridiculously precocious thing that he's done in his first two full seasons in charge. And it's not just that they've been promoted back to back, which has it only ever happened three times before? It hasn't happened very, very often. It's really, and it hasn't happened since 2012, I think. So this is really quite historic what he's done. But, and you know, hands in the air here, haven't followed the championship too closely this season, but apparently they play really exciting football, and you can see it with the number of goals that they've scored as well. They've had 18 different goal scorers this season in the first team squad. That's a lot. So they've done it in style. They've done it entertaining. Let's see how they get on in the Premier League now, because Burnley were pretty good in the Championship last season, and it's been quite a difficult season for them in the Premier League. But, you know, not to bring Ipswich fans down, congratulations. Obviously, I was born and raised in London, in England, and when I was growing up, Ipswich were a top-flight team. They were someone that had always been there, pretty much, and they've won the European Cup in the past. This is a big club, history, tradition, huge fan base. They're in a part of England as well, where there aren't many other football clubs, so they've got a big catchment area, big rivalry with Norwich as well. We might get a East Anglia derby in the Premier League next season still, who knows? And yeah, it's a great story.
And also, more importantly, there's a big chance we'll have a couple of Aussies playing in the Premier League for the first time in some time now. Cameron Burgess is there, and Massimo Luongo. Cameron Burgess, I think his contract runs out in the summer, so I'm not quite sure. Let's hope he's still there. But great news for Australian football to have a couple of more Aussies back in the Premier League. It's been a long time coming.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Women's FA Cup final is live and exclusively on Optus Sport this weekend, with Manchester United and Tottenham going head-to-head. In the lead-up, though, Narelle and Ash are on the Women's Football Wrap, and well, girls, the title race, we thought it was done and dusted, but it's back on.
Well, what a week it's been, Ash. A few days ago, we thought Chelsea were out of the title race. Everyone did, including Emma Hayes. And now, after this weekend, she has said it's not f***ing over.
It's not over.
It's been a roller coaster. So Chelsea lost to Liverpool midweek, got a big win over Bristol, and in between all that, Manchester City lost to Arsenal. You couldn't write it.
It has been a roller coaster of emotions, even for us. I think we were messaging on Thursday saying, oh, here we go. Chelsea's had their downfall. This is our shot for someone else. But Arsenal, they've decided they're going to be the party poopers and get another big result against one of the top teams in the league. Tell you what, if they could consistently beat the teams lower than them on the table, they'd be another one of the challengers for the title, but unfortunately they're not. Did you see Chelsea bouncing back like they did on the weekend?
Yeah, well, Bristol, as we know, are relegated, so maybe their mind's already in the championship, I don't know, but I didn't think it'd be that much of a scoreline, so 8-0, and going into it, they knew 3 points were a must, but also goal difference, so they've smashed City's entire goal difference now. So it very well might come down to that on the final day. But this is what we wanted, right? We wanted it to come down to the final weekend, which it will do.
Yes, exactly. We've seen a few leagues wrap up early over the weekend. Germany, Spain, I think France as well. So to have the WSL come down to the last weekend is so exciting, isn't it? And I mean, it was just like a perfect send-off as well, I think, for the group of like Emma Hayes, Fran Kirby, Maren Mjelde all leaving Kings Meadow at the end of the season. Like, that was a ruthless performance by Chelsea. You know, I don't know about you if you feel sorry at all for Bristol, but like, I loved watching that happen, that demo, like the determination that they showed in that game was fantastic. And they, you know, every time a ball went in the back of the net, they'd grab it, they'd sprint back to halfway, even after the eighth goal. You know, Aggie Beaver-Jones is cramping and she's still, you know, getting told to get up, run back to halfway, let's keep going. It was very interesting to watch.
Well, it's no secret that I'm not the biggest Chelsea fan, no. But I have to admit, after seeing them being knocked out of the Champions League and then losing to Liverpool, I did start to feel sorry for them. But mentally, it must take a lot to bounce back from a week from hell, I guess.
Yes, they had a very... And I think you saw in that Liverpool performance that they were tired. They still really, really wanted the win, but they couldn't get it done. They were so disappointed at the end of it. And then to bounce back so quickly like that after, a bit of congestion, fixture congestion, was massive for them. And, you know, I think this will be the kick that they need if they want to get over the line. They've still got two games left as well.
Yeah, so round 22, both Chelsea and City are away. But before that, next Thursday, Chelsea are away to Tottenham.
Yep.
So it's going to be a very interesting end to the season. Schwartzy, I don't know if you agree, but yeah, definitely be watching next Thursday's match between Tottenham and Chelsea.
Oh, it's very, very exciting. Obviously, Chelsea still have two games to go. They got Spurs in the last... week leading up to the last game of the season, where they then play Manchester United away. City have Villa away, all to play for. I mean, City currently on 52 points with a plus 45 goal difference, whereas Chelsea, with that game in hand, have 49 points and a plus 46 goal difference. I'm assuming they're going to beat Aston Villa away. They'll pick up on their goal difference. So literally, it's going to come down to who wins last game of the season. And you would feel that if Chelsea are ahead, even though they're playing United away, even though they lost to them in the FA Cup semi-final, I still fancy Chelsea to get it over the line. And remarkably, I've changed my mind completely on this because I thought it was City. City all the way. I thought City was going to win it. But I think now Chelsea just have that advantage. And this, remember, this will be the first time we're going to have a winner in the WSL that have lost three games in a season, which has never, ever happened before. And it goes to show you how competitive this league has become and is getting even more competitive, because it's only going to get bigger and better as the seasons go on. So I can't wait. Let's move on to La Liga. You said it for weeks and weeks, weeks now, Phil. You said at the beginning of the season, it was Real Madrid's title to lose pretty much, and that they're going to win the title. And they ended up doing it. I mean, they did it comfortably at home to Cadiz. They obviously didn't know they'd won it at that stage, but they beat them 3-0. But it wasn't that comfortable, was it, for Real Madrid necessarily? I mean, that 0-0, they could have easily found themselves 1-0 behind, but my mate Thibaut Courtois made his first appearance, or certainly his first appearance in a long, long time, in goal for Real Madrid, made a very, very crucial save. And then a minute later, Brahim Diaz scores to make it 1-0. Real Madrid, you said it. It was really their title to lose, right?
Worthy, worthy champions, Real Madrid. They've been, by some distance and for some time, the best team in La Liga this season. Even though in the Clásicos against Barcelona, the margins were pretty fine. They won both of them, but with goals in injury time. But generally speaking, they've scored more goals than anyone else. They've only lost one game. They've won more matches than anyone else. They have been consistently the best team. And as we said, worthy, worthy champions. They're currently 14 points ahead of Barcelona, 13 points ahead of Girona, who helped them massively by beating Barcelona just after Real Madrid had beaten Cadiz, which handed Real Madrid the league title for a 36th time. And yeah, you said it wasn't necessarily comfortable against Cadiz. It was... I think everybody knew that Real Madrid were going to win this game. Cadiz are the lowest scorers in the division. They had one chance.
It's my team. Don't knock my team, all right? Don't knock my team.
I was there with a load of Cadiz fans, mate. My son was wearing his Cadiz shirt. It was a very Cadiz afternoon for me, and still everybody kind of expected Real Madrid to win. And even the Real Madrid fans, they were singing campeones, campeones, even before they had actually been crowned champions, because they knew if it wasn't at on Saturday it was going to be next week, or we knew that Real Madrid were going to be champions given the distance they had racked up against the chasing pack. And yeah, now they're going to focus on Wednesday night in the Champions League. There weren't any team celebrations on Saturday. Usually they go to Plaza Cibeles, which is a big fountain square in the centre of Madrid. And there's tens and tens and tens of thousands of Madridistas, and the team go there on a bus. They didn't do that because they're focused on the Champions League semi-final second leg against Bayern Munich on Wednesday night. But yeah, Real Madrid champions. And I called it at the start of the season, so I'm happy that you mentioned that. Not me.
I mean, you got one right, so that's well done, Phil. You got one of your predictions right for this season.
I think I also said Chelsea would get Champions League, so you know.
Well, so I'm saying you got one right, so you've done well, mate. Yeah. Jules, we've mentioned a couple of times on this podcast that there's potentially a dynasty starting with Real Madrid, certainly with the signing of Kylian Mbappe imminent, obviously Jude Bellingham's emergence. When you look at the quality of players that they have, Vinicius Junior, Rodrigo, you know, there's a list of players goes on and on and on, and Phil will give us a few more that are probably signing in the summer as well. Is that very much possible?
Yeah, I think it's scary even when you think how good they've been this season. Defensively as well, let's not forget, 22 goals conceded is pretty incredible. I think only Inter Milan in the big five leagues have conceded less goals than them with 19 this season. So defensively they've been super strong, even without Militao and Courtois for the whole season, and Alaba for most of the season. Really, really impressive, with Tchouaméni sometimes playing a centre-back, with Nacho, who in his last season has still done well when he was called upon. And when you think that on top of all of that, Carlo being maybe for me at his best this season in terms of managing the squad, in terms of some of the tactics we saw against Manchester City in the first leg of that quarterfinal, his tactical masterclass of putting Rodrigo and Vini on the same side, on the left side, because Walker was not there for City, all of that, Carlo at his best. And if on top of that, Jude Bellingham, of course, incredible, we've said it many times, on top of that, you add Kylian to this squad, Endrick, who's going to also come from Brazil, you might keep Joselu because he's cheap and he gives you something else as a number nine, a very different profile. Plus all the youth of Valverde and Camavinga and Tchouaméni, even if Modric is going to leave, you still have Cruz, who maybe has had one of his best seasons of his career, even at his age this season. It's really, really, really scary, I think, if you are not Real Madrid and not a Real Madrid fan.
Phil, I've got a big question for you. Thibaut Courtois was back, played well, arguably got one of the biggest cheers of the game with that one-on-one save, the noise in the stadium when he made that save. Does he start against Bayern Munich?
It was quite funny. The fans were literally cheering every touch that Courtois made, even when it was just being played passed back to him and he just received it to play the pass out. They were cheering because they knew how important it was to have Thibaut Courtois back. And Lunin's going to start against Bayern Munich. I think that's pretty clear, and I think Ancelotti has alluded to it. But then in a hypothetical Champions League final, which they're not there yet, but in a hypothetical Champions League final, that would be the big question. And I think Courtois would possibly make it. What would be that, the 1st of June? He'd have a month. I mean, yeah, he'd have a few almost dead rubber La Liga games to maybe get up to scratch. But yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves. They're not in the final yet. But if they were to get into the final, I think Courtois would possibly play. But on Wednesday night, it's going to be Lunin.
We have routinely said on this podcast, hashtag always watch Girona. It had multiple meanings this week. Not only did producer saying come back to overcome Barcelona, but doing so, they secured the top four spot for themselves and, of course, handed the title from Barcelona to Real Madrid. Not that Girona did it, but, they played a part in the end. I mean, what a story. We talked about Ipswich Town and the promotion, and that's sensational, and they're two very different things. But what Girona has been able to accomplish this season, Phil, is off the chart, right? I mean, do people in Spain still pinch themselves over what Girona's doing?
It's their fourth season in La Liga, Schwartzy. It's the fourth season in their history in the top flight of Spanish football. They've got the 14th biggest salary budget in the division. And yes, they are part of the City Football Group. And yes, that does mean shared resources, access to players, access to data and information. But it's still a ridiculous achievement. You look at the amount of money that they've spent, and they haven't spent a huge amount of money. You look at the amount of players they've got from City Football Group, and it's just two players on loan from the City Football Group. This is an extraordinary achievement. The way they've done it as well, playing a really entertaining, attractive brand of football.
But they haven't gone, you said they're part of the City Group, they haven't gone on and bought massive names, right? They've brought in, no. Yes, yeah, some well-known names in Daley Blind and Eric Garcia, but Eric Garcia struggled then to play at Barcelona. Daley Blind, you don't say, is at the back end of his career. Gazzaniga and goal. So they haven't gone and just brought in massive, massive name players. I mean, Christian Stuani is still a big, big player for them.
Yes.
Savio is the one. Savio is the one that benefited the most from the City Group. Well, no, because they wouldn't have been able to spend 20 million on him. So they got him because he was already owned by a club from the City Group.
And that's right, but he struggled in France, didn't he? He didn't have the same impact that he's had now.
No, he never played.
That's right. So he struggled in the Netherlands.
He's the pure example of what multi-club ownership can do for you. If you're a small club like Girona, who could have never afforded him, you got him because he already belonged to your group. I've got nothing against it. I'm just saying, like...
Jules,
without that.
The other end of the multi-group situation is Troyes, isn't it? Yeah. You are part of the City Football Group. And
terrible.
I think, is Savio part...
Savio is a Troyes player.
He's a Troyes player. He's their record signing. He's never played for them. He's smashing it up with Girona. And Troyes are getting relegated to the third division?
Again, so we talked about Ipswich, two promotions in a row. Is there two relegations in a row for Troyes and the City Group?
Yeah, the last game was...
But anyway, back to Girona.
Was held up, right? The last game was held up because of crowd invasion, right? Pitch invasion in Troyes.
They threw flares and the players threw them back. Yeah. It was a mess, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, back on to Girona, Phil.
Yeah, back to Girona. It's great. I mean, listen, I think everybody has their, you know, massive reservations about multi-club ownership, to be honest. It's not something that I'm not necessarily comfortable with it.
I like this idea, though. Yep. In terms of the way that Girona's done it, I really like it. I don't have a problem with it. I get what you're saying. They would never
But they've
be
done it at the expense of Troyes.
Yeah, well, I mean that could be debated about a lot of clubs and about signing players. And, you know, Barcelona did it a couple of years ago, didn't they? When they that silly rule that you have in Spain about if you have a certain number of strikers injured or players in one position injured, you and every player has a buyout clause, you can force a purchase of a player, which I just find ridiculous, right?
But yeah, I mean, that's not exactly the same, but yeah.
No, I know, but what I'm saying is the influence, the impact. What I'm saying is the impact it can have on clubs. You mentioned Troyes and the impact that had Savio not playing there and playing at Girona instead of Troyes, right? It's happened in other ways as well where it's not necessarily fair all the time. But
that's the City Football Group going, let's take him from here and let's put him here and let's move him here. It doesn't feel... natural. I don't know.
Well, but they've done it. They've done it better. Like the Leipzig, you know. So the Red Bull product. They do the same thing, right? They haven't gone on and dominated the world, but they've been very successful, and certainly financially, they've reaped the rewards from being able to do it, moving from one to the other. Obviously, they're paying transfer fees, but you could argue and say, well, possibly reduced and so forth, right? But I like the idea of this, that Savio, for example, a player that never played in France and played in Holland and struggled, but came to La Liga and played for little Girona and has been outstanding. The fact that they've gone and still gone and bought players like Dovnik, and who's been absolutely sensational, scored his 20th La Liga goal on the weekend. These sort of stories wouldn't happen unless, I think, you had this situation, a club like Girona having the ability to possibly bring in players on slightly more money than they normally would, but players that not necessarily would be having the opportunity elsewhere. The other player is Porto, I have to mention. First touch, scores, and then his second goal, the fourth goal? I mean, absolutely world-class, right, Phil?
Amazing.
It's an unreal goal. Go and watch it. Go and watch it again. Go and watch it on repeat, because it is a sensational strike from Porto, who afterwards he said, I feel indebted to this club. He felt responsible. He'd been with them before. He'd been with them when they went down, when they were relegated in 2019. So he felt responsible for that. So he came back to the club and helped them, and he's scored seven goals, mostly off the bench this season. So he's been one of these players who is not... not linked to the City Football Group at all. And one of these kind of disparate footballers who you mentioned, you know, Daley Blind's there, Eric Garcia, Paulo Gazzaniga, players who have been in the Premier League and seem a little bit random to be smashing up in La Liga now. And Porto is one of those. And he's not necessarily the most technically talented players. And that seems ridiculous that I'm saying that, given the goal that he just
scored. The goal he scored, yeah.
He isn't. Yeah, but he scored an amazing goal, and he's one of Girona's success stories this season.
Barcelona, Xavi said he's staying, and they're going to lose. Should he just stay permanently, saying I'm leaving, and then they continue to keep play well because he's leaving eventually? Phil, there's a big, huge sigh of like.
I mean, Xavi said a lot of things. To be honest, he said so many things. I mean, after this game, where. They've lost, and Real Madrid are champions. Just say, you know, congratulations to Real Madrid. Whatever, we weren't at our best. And he said we were superior to Real Madrid and superior to Girona in all the games that we played against them this season. But we just couldn't see out the victory. We didn't know how to control it. But we were superior to them. You lost all four of the games, mate. Like you weren't superior to them. And it just feels like sometimes he talks a little bit too much. And it's been a really, really bad last few weeks for Barcelona. It started with Jules' boys spanking them in the Champions League somewhat unexpectedly, given how that tie had started. And it's ended with them losing to Girona again. I mean, they conceded 8 goals to Girona across the two games. 8 goals. I mean, you're not superior if you concede.
But they were
goals.
The better team, right? Each time. They should have won the league. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean...
Listen, now they were. To be fair, they had the game pretty controlled. They were 2-1 up. They had the game pretty controlled.
They had good moments.
And that's what he's alluding to. I understand that. But then for your manager to come out and say, no, we were superior. We were superior in all of the games. And, you know, I just think the optics aren't great on that. Maybe Xavi just needs to rethink a little bit, because you need to be a bit more self-critical. And if you can't see out matches that you're in control of, something's wrong.
You get your popcorn.
Yeah, it's not stand-up comedy. It's like drama. It's like a drama, like a melodrama or like a soap opera. I mean, Barca at the moment are just a soap opera anyway, like a Latin American telenovela. It's all dramatic. It's all emotion. It's all ups and downs. It's a roller coaster. You never really know what's going to happen. So, yeah.
So, Jules, so Real Madrid, we talk about a dynasty, and then that kind of opens the rest up, doesn't it? I mean, you know, rather than in the past where you're talking about top two, top three teams, can you see it now in La Liga that there's obviously Real Madrid a cut above everyone else, and then the rest, there's a whole number of teams that can compete and possibly even push Real Madrid?
Yeah, absolutely. Which I don't think La Liga's title race will be very exciting next season and the seasons that follow, because I think Real Madrid are going to be far too strong.
But still watch, everyone. It's still great.
Still watch, of course. Yeah, still watch on Optusport. Yeah. It's still a great league. I'm just saying there will be one team that will be better than the others, which is fine. It happens in other leagues as well. But below that, it's going to be very exciting between Girona. How well or not are they going to do next season? Who's going to still be there? Is Mitchell still going to be on the bench, or is he going to go to a bigger club? What about Savio? We know he's leaving already, but what about the other stars of that team? What about Barcelona? With what investment in the summer can they go and sign players? Do they have to sell first someone like De Jong, for example, or Araujo before reinvesting that money, because they have zero money? What about Atletico and El Cholo and Griezmann getting older? What about Athletic Club de Bilbao and if Valverde stay? What about Nico Williams, if he's staying or not? How far more can they take this team? And then Villarreal and then all the others. So yeah, it's going to be fascinating. The two Sevilla clubs, it's still great. But I love the fact that Kylian is going to Real Madrid and to Spain, and he's going to smash it there. And I just can't wait to see Vini, Bellingham and Kylian all together playing. It's going to be amazing. And I think there's a generation of Phil's son's age, for example, who are going to grow up with this super team, really, that we haven't seen very often, certainly when we were younger, but also really in the history of the game. And to have the chance to be able to watch a team like that every weekend is going to be amazing. So for that, I love. For the rest, well, we'll focus on who finished second, third, fourth and fifth.
That was brilliantly sold, Jules. I mean, I couldn't have done a better job myself. That was fantastic. It's true. I agree with everything that Jules said. La Liga is about drama. It's about storylines. It's about passion. And there will still be loads of that. So even though Real Madrid are probably going to dominate for a long while, still subscribe, still watch on Optusport, because it's going to be great.
We thought that was going to happen in the Bundesliga with Bayern Munich, and it didn't happen. So look, there's still hope. It may still be different next season. Let's wait and see what happens.
Well, they won 10 in a row, so it's kind of hard.
No, but I mean, like, they were supposed to win it again, and they didn't, and Leverkusen came from nowhere. Let's see what happens in La Liga. That's why it makes it so interesting. Anything can happen in football, as we've all witnessed many, many times before. Guys, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Jules, for joining me, as always. Remember, Optus Sport is the only place you can watch the Premier League title race, La Liga, J-League, K-League, and WSL live, as well as the Euro 2024 and Copa America in a few months' time. See you next week on the Optus Sport Football Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.